In the last episode, we took a look at the background of persecution in the early centuries of the church. That is why Christians faced such hostility in the realm of the Roman Empire. The first official wave of persecution at the hands of Roman officials came in AD 64, during the reign of the Emperor Nero. A fire began on July 19th of that year. It lasted 9 days, and it destroyed 10 of Rome's 14 districts, created massive suffering for the city's about 1 million inhabitants. Now, this was neither the first nor the last fire to devastate the city, but it was probably the most severe. A rumor pointed the finger at Nero as its cause. His desire to remake the city after his own grand plan was well known. So was his reputation for doing what he pleased, regardless of the cost to others. As the outrage for the devastation grew, Nero began to fear the wrath of the mob. It didn't take him long to settle on a likely scapegoat. You see, there was a new and growing sect in the city that was already under suspicion. Convenient that they held a belief in the end of the world by fire. Large numbers of Christians were arrested. While most of them were eventually released, some were crucified. But then things got dark. They got sinister, as though kind of a sick mind went to work devising ingenious methods to execute them. They were sewn inside cow skins thrown to vicious dogs that tore them apart. They were tied to bulls and dragged to death through the streets. Christians believed that the world would end in fire. Nero was more than happy to make their lives end that way. So he tied them to stakes in his garden, covered them in pitch, and then lit them ablaze. It's during this persecution both the apostles Paul and Peter were martyred in Rome. The Neronian persecution is notable in that it set a precedent for why the followers of Jesus were persecuted. Though persecution didn't really extend beyond Rome at that time, Christians in the city were subjected to arrest and execution on the charge that they were arsonists. Fire was dreaded in Rome due to its tendency to spread from house to house. This first wave of official persecution was uncommon for the first and second centuries, but it did presage what was to come. For long periods, Christians enjoyed a measure of peace, but they knew that persecution could break out at any moment. All it took was some influential person taking umbrage at something that they believed or something that some Christian had done, and the arrests would start up again. Because being a Christian had become technically illegal. After the first flurry of arrests and executions in the mid-60s, persecution diminished, then flared up again in 95 during Domitian's reign. It was during this wave of hardship that began with the Jews. Jews refused to pay a new tax that was levied to fund the construction of Jupiter's temple on the Capitoline Hill. Domitian decided to use this break with the obstinate Jews to enforce emperor worship. When they refused to take the oath, Christians were arrested for treason. Those arrested lost their property, many were banished, and others were executed, especially their leaders. It was at this time that the Apostle John was exiled to the prison island of Patmos. And legend says that John had been arrested by zealous officials hopeful to ingratiate themselves with the emperor. They thought to execute John by boiling him in oil, sure to terrorize other would-be Christian leaders into submission. But God miraculously turned the experience into a day at the spa. John came out with not a hint of distress. Now fearful of whatever deity had preserved him, John was bundled up and packed off to the one place that he could do the least amount of damage, an island prison called Patmos, a lonely rock in the Mediterranean. I guess their thinking was, hey, we tried to kill this guy. That didn't work. Let's not try that again, lest the deity protecting him goes after us. But we can't turn him loose. He'll just make more followers of Jesus, even more now that he's a living, breathing, walking miracle. So let's stick him on Patmos. He can't do any damage there. There's what, a couple dozen criminals and some turtles? Glad to break it to you guys. That plan didn't work out so well. It was on Patmos that John received the visions that became the book of Revelation. That provided courage to millions of persecuted believers ever since. It wasn't really till the early second century that Rome established a policy for dealing with Christians. Of growing concern was the number of soldiers converting to the new faith. What effect would their religion have on their fitness to serve in the legions? A lawyer named Pliny the Younger because his famous uncle was the famous author and philosopher Pliny the Elder, was governor in North Asia from 111 to 113. A revival among Christians must have taken place because there was a massive defection from paganism swelling the ranks. Pliny was of a mind that to be a good Roman meant to hold that civic virtue that we looked at last time, pietas, which meant adhering to the official religion of the empire, paganism. So many forsaking the old gods had to be bad for the empire's well-being. Pliny gave Christians three chances to recant, each time with increasing threats of punishment if they refused. And if they resisted recanting after these three warnings, they were executed. But Pliny was unsure of this treatment accurately reflecting the wishes of the one to whom he owed his office, the Emperor Trajan. As I shared in the previous episode, he wrote asking for advice. Trajan responded that Pliny wasn't to make it a policy to go on a search and destroy mission for Christians. If and when they happened to be brought to him, having been convicted of being a Christian, they were to be punished, some by torture to encourage them to recanting, and if they obstinately refused the state's generous mercy, they were to be executed. Trajan added that anonymous charges were not to be entertained. The accuser had to face the accused. This is the first real evidence that we have of an official policy regarding Christians. It wasn't long until officials across the empire used Trajan's guidelines in dealing with the Christians. Many were martyred, including Ignatius, the bishop of Antioch, who in 115 was thrown to the beasts in the arena at Rome. Now, Pliny was sure that Christians were guilty of something. He just wasn't sure what. He put no stock whatever in the wild rumors that they were incestuous cannibals. He wrote, quote, "I do not know just what to do with the Christians, for I have never been present at one of their trials. Is just being a Christian enough to punish, or must something bad actually have been done? What I have done in the case of those who admitted they were Christians was to order them sent to Rome, if citizens. If not, to have them killed. I was sure they deserved to be punished because they were so stubborn," unquote. Now, what stubbornness did Pliny mean, and how did these early Christians exhibit it? What was it that they were being required to do that they couldn't? It was their failure to laud the emperor's genius, as it was called. The main cause of Rome's persecution of Jesus' followers came about from the tradition of emperor worship. The contest between Christ and Caesar didn't happen overnight. It rose gradually because the practice of emperor worship rose gradually to attain a central place in the life of the empire. The roots of emperor worship lay in how Romans viewed the benefit of their hegemony, their success as conquerors. When and where they took over, a mostly impartial justice arrived. People were freed from the caprice of fickle tyrants. Roads were clear to bandits, the sea of pirates. Security came to most regions. This came to be called the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. But it was a peace enforced by a sharp sword in the hand of a well-trained soldier. Many regions had a profound gratitude to Rome for disposing of their previous rulers, replacing them with, if not outright benevolent governors, at least their avarice was somewhat restrained. Because they already believed in a host of deities, it was easy to add one more, Roma, the goddess of Rome. By the 2nd century BC, there were dozens of temples in Asia Minor to her. But humans like symbols, something they can see. So it wasn't long before the spirit of Rome was regarded as imbuing the empire's leader, the emperor. He was Rome, its embodiment. The first temple to the godhead of the emperor was built in 29 BC at Pergamum in Asia Minor. Now, at first, Roman emperors hesitated to accept this reverence. In the mid-first century, Claudius refused to allow temples to be erected to him because of the ostentatiousness that they suggested. But the idea grew and became attractive to later emperors. The logic was that the empire needed something to unite its far-flung provinces in a single uniform practice, a kind of, well, pledge of allegiance. Since nothing has the potential to unite like a common religion, Caesar worshipped seemed a ready tool to forge loyalty. Since there was little chance that any of the disparate religions of the various regions of the empire would be accepted by all, why not rally under one thing they all embraced, the political yoke of Rome? Emperor worship became a centerpiece of imperial policy. It was officially organized in every province. Temples to the emperor appeared everywhere. But if loyalty to Rome was declared by worshiping the emperor, what did a refusal to worship him mean? Well, logic pointed to a single answer, treason. Christians who refused to offer a pinch of incense while saying Caesar is Lord were branded as dangerous traitors, subversives whose presence couldn't just be overlooked, for surely the gods were watching and required those who defied them to be punished. During the reign of the Emperor Decius in the mid-3rd century, Caesar worship was made universal and compulsory for everyone in the empire, with the single exception of the Jews. On a set day each year, everyone had to come to the temple of Caesar and burn a pinch of incense while saying, "Caesar is Lord." He was then given a labellus, a certificate to guarantee that he'd taken the oath and sworn by the emperor's genius. He could then go and worship any god he liked, so long as the worship didn't affect public decency and order. Caesar worship was a political loyalty test, a way to register someone as a good citizen, as Rome, of course, defined it. But of course, it proved nothing about a person's real loyalty. Christians who couldn't participate in Caesar worship were, in fact, often better citizens than those who took the oath, because their holy writings enjoined them to pray for those in authority. Coins from that time have texts given in adulation by Romans to the emperor, remarkably similar to the praise that Christians offered Christ. These coins, saying things like, "Hail, Lord of the earth, invincible, power, glory, honor, blessed, great, worthy art thou to inherit the kingdom." Well, that sounds an awful lot like the praise directed to Jesus in Revelation. The worship of Christ and Caesar butted heads. No pious Christian could say Caesar is Lord, because Jesus alone was Lord. But to most Romans, Christians seemed stupidly intolerant. A pagan might say to a Christian, "Hey, just go along to get along, for goodness sake. If there really is only one God, as you Christians claim, what harm is there in burning a pinch of incense and mouthing empty words? It'll at least remove the suspicious and hostile eye of Rome from you." While that may have been an eminently practical idea to many pagans, it was unthinkable to Christians. Although some, in fact, did use this as justification for obtaining a labellus. Most Christians saw it more as saying Caesar is Lord was spiritual adultery. It was cheating on Jesus. Burning incense and taking the oath would be like, well, cheating on your spouse, and then justifying it by saying that there was no love involved. It was just sex. Something for us to ponder is how this contest between Caesar and Christ, which began near the start of the church, will, according to a futurist interpretation of Bible prophecy, come around again at the end. In the book of Revelation, John presents a major struggle between the forces of heaven and hell, with earth being the battlefield. It's a contest of kingdoms, gods and the devils, with Satan's merging with a political empire intent on wiping out believers. Now, historicists see that as having been fulfilled in the early centuries of the church. Futurists see it as something yet future, a recapitulation of what's already happened, but on a much wider scale. Anyway, Trajan's successor as emperor was Hadrian. He quietly continued Trajan's policy from 117 to 138. And I say quietly because he neither renewed nor rescinded the call for persecution. It became a matter of imperial precedence. The result was that persecution became regional. Some governors hated the new sect and used their official cover to persecute them. Most governors, they didn't really care. Christians weren't causing any trouble, so why kick a hornet's nest? They left believers alone. But if suddenly there was a, well, leanness in the ranks of fighters for the arena, well, they could always crank up another round of persecution, snag some Christians as fodder for the arena. And besides, the church was getting pretty big. Time to trim the hedge. Occasionally, at heathen festivals, the mob would drink too much, and they'd want some entertainment, and so they'd demand the blood of Christians. This became so common, Hadrian published an edict against such riots. Christians couldn't just be roused by the mob out of their homes and meeting places and carried off to some temple or arena where their heads were used to crack rocks. No, Christians were to be given the justice of the courts. Yes, they could be executed for being Christians, but only after being properly charged and tried. During Hadrian's reign, this policy saw the ranks of Christians grow, their wealth improve, their scholarship advance, and their influence spread. From 139 to 161, the Emperor Ananias Pius appears to have personally favored Jesus' followers, but officially he continued the precedent of imperial policy. What that means is, little direction came from Rome about how Christians were to be handled. Persecution at this time was sporadic, regional, and temporary. It might flare up for a few months with mobs rioting and demanding blood, and then several years would pass with nary a whisper or threat. A student of the Apostle John, Polycarp, who was the bishop of Smyrna, was martyred in this way. When a mob rioted and demanded some Christians pay for their defiance of the old ways and gods. And so, we might call this period the time of provincial persecution. A new approach in dealing with Christians was adopted by Marcus Aurelius, who reigned from 161 to 180. Now, Aurelius is known as the philosopher emperor. He authored a volume on Stoic philosophy called Meditations. It was really more a series of notes to himself, but it became a classic of ancient literature. Aurelius bore not a shred of sympathy for the idea of life after death and detested as intellectually inferior anyone who carried a hope in immortality. Reversing Trajan's policy of not going after Christians, Aurelius crafted a system of spies to gather intelligence and evidence against them. Rather than check riots that frequently called for martyrs' blood, as the previous emperors had done, Aurelius encouraged them. During his reign, Christians were blamed for natural catastrophes. The supposition was that the gods were upset, that the Christians weren't being persecuted by good Romans. With this as their moral backing and making up for lost time, persecution under Aurelius moved to a new level of brutality. Thousands lost their heads or were tossed to the beasts. It was at this time that Justin Martyr became one. And we ought to note that as fierce as the Aurelian persecution was, no official edict called for an empire-wide extermination of Christians, nor did one come during the reigns of Septimius Severus from 193 to 211 or Maximinus from 235 to 238, when persecution of the followers of Christ was renewed. The Severian campaign sought to root out the church in Egypt and North Africa, while the Maximinus chapter aimed only at Christian leaders in specific locales. The mid-3rd century saw a dramatic change. As Rome celebrated its thousand-year anniversary, people cast longing eyes back to the golden age and the glory days of a bygone era of power and prosperity. In comparison, Rome now seemed a tottering old hag hobbling along on arthritic knees. She was no longer able to kick away the barbarian dog snapping at her heels. Pagan superstition assumed the gods would favor their ancestors for their devotion, were now punishing them for allowing the Christians to reject them. Well, that being the case, wasn't it morally right and for the public good to actively go after the followers of Jesus? That was the thinking. Decius only ruled from 249 to 51, but he was convinced that maintaining Rome's religious cultus was essential to political stability and a return to prosperity. As soon as he took the imperial purple, he gave orders that everyone in the empire had to swear by the emperor's genius, that meaning the practice of emperor worship. This flushed out Christians who refused. They were declared traitors, enemies of the emperor, the state, and public good. Their very presence was deemed a dangerous blight since the wrath of the gods was on them. As harsh as all of this sounds, the evidence indicates that at first the goal wasn't to kill them so much as it was to get them to recant under the threat of pain. Getting a Christian to recant was far more effective than killing them because some people are inspired by martyrdom. And of course, martyrs were held in ultra-high esteem by the church. So much so, a little bit later, we'll find the church leaders telling church members to use common sense and to not run around making a big deal about being a believer just so that they would be arrested and executed. Most officials preferred apostates to martyrs. We can think of it this way. In ancient warfare, men would psych and pump themselves up in anticipation of battle. Once battle began, you wanted to present yourself like a man, you know, tough and courageous. When you see your buddies taking blows and giving as good as you get, you stay shoulder to shoulder. You're a band of brothers. But when one guy turns his back to the enemy and begins to run, well, that is a fast-spreading contagion of fear. And soon the entire line collapses in what's called a rout. Watching some Christians publicly executed for their faith often inspired as many as it spooked. But hearing of Christians recanting and returning to the paganism of their past made many wonder why they should remain true. Under Decius, the first to be seized as treasonous were church leaders. The hope was that a leaderless church would fall apart, and in some places it did. But in others, it went on as if nothing had changed. In those places where the church winked out, It was because by the mid-third century, Christianity had already produced a brand of faith that was more image than substance. Shocking as it may seem to some, there's been shallow Christians since the beginning. Now, under Decius, they were fleshed out into the open where they were forced to recant or die. Recant they did, because their faith was more social than sincere. But a host of others suffered martyrdom. After a year, it was clear that the Decian persecution wouldn't succeed in its goal to end the faith. In July of 251, Decius was killed in battle. His edict was no longer enforced. In 253, Valerian became emperor. He was at first friendly to the faith, but a series of calamities stirred his advisors to press him to renew the pogroms and appeasement of the gods. During this wave of persecution, several great leaders of the church were killed. Then, the 43 years from 260 to 303 were a time of relative peace for Christians. But it was just the calm before the storm, which arrived with the ascension of Diocletian. While his origins are sketchy, it seems that Diocletian was a slave son who worked himself up to supreme power. A brilliant administrator, Diocletian recognized what previous rulers ought to have, that Rome was just too large to be led by a single ruler. I'll leave it to you to listen to Mike Duncan's The History of Rome podcast to learn the details of Diocletian's reign. Edward Gibbon, author of The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, called Diocletian a second Augustus because he believes that he framed a new empire rather than just restore the old. Indeed, Diocletian distanced himself from his political ancestors and heritage. He very consciously adopted the ostentatiousness of an Eastern ruler, something that previous Roman emperors regarded as scandalous. It was he who divided the empire into a formal East and West, each with its own Augustus and a subordinate Caesar. In his first two decades in the purple, Diocletian honored the toleration edict that Galenus had passed in 259, which restored Christian churches and burial places. His wife and daughter, along with most of his court and officials, were either Christians or were favorable to them because their wives and friends were. The emperor himself was a pagan of the more, superstitious flavor. But as a pragmatic politician, he believed restoring the empire demanded a return to the old religion. Although due to family and friends, he postponed the religious question, ultimately, he had to take it on. There could be no peaceful coexistence between Christianity and paganism. It was high noon in Diocletian's court. The chief instigator in all of this was Diocletian's co-ruler, his son-in-law, Galerius. He prevailed on Diocletian to authorize the persecution for which his reign is so well known. In 303, at Galerius's urging, Diocletian issued a series of edicts calling for the total eradication of Christianity. Places of worship were to be torn down, sacred writings burned, and the clergy slaughtered. The next year, all Christians had to engage in a public display of emperor worship or face immediate execution. Although it wasn't exactly like this, it's close. A raised dais was built in the center of town with a little altar where people would drop a pinch of incense and say, "Caesar is Lord." Then they would take a few more steps and be handed a libellus, a little scroll, affirming that they were good, loyal subjects. Another path led from the altar to a chopping block where an executioner stood. Those who refused to drop incense and instead said, "Jesus, not Caesar, is Lord," they took that route where they got a haircut at the neck. And thousands died. In the Eastern Empire, where Diocletian and Galerius ruled, the persecution was especially fierce. The Western Augustus, Maximian, fastidiously carried out the edicts in Italy and Africa, but his subordinate, Constantius, who ruled Gaul, Britain, and Spain, refused to execute people for their faith. Persecution effectively ended in 305, when Diocletian abdicated and retired to grow cabbages at his estate. But it was Galerius who'd put Diocletian up to it in the first place, and Galerius stepped into the role of the Eastern Augustus. So, why didn't the persecutions continue under him? Well, the answer to that is because Galerius realized it wasn't working. He admitted that the policy of eradicating Christianity had failed miserably. In fact, he reversed himself and wrote this, quote, "Wherefore, for this our indulgence, they ought to pray to their God for our safety, for that of the Republic and for their own, that the Republic may continue uninjured on every side and that they may be able to live securely in their homes," unquote. Of course, he's speaking about the Christians. It's reported that at the end of his life, as he lay abed, he asked his Christian subjects to pray for him. To encourage their prayers, he passed an edict of toleration in 311, officially ending persecution. It was followed a year later by Constantine's famous Edict of Milan, saying much the same. We're going to end this episode by considering the impact that persecution had on the church. Most emperors eventually realized, as did Galerius too late, that persecution didn't work. Killing Christians didn't end the faith. On the contrary, many were won to Christ by observing the gracious and courageous way that so many martyrs had died. A quote from the early church father Tertullian is often given. The blood of martyrs is seed. The sheer number of Christians may be less due to persecution thinning their ranks, but a positive effect that it yielded was that those who did claim the name of Christ were real deal followers of the Son of God. People didn't join a church just so that they could pad their resume or enhance their social standing. You know, being a Christian was risky across the board. People stood in danger socially, economically, and physically. Persecution also encouraged the spread of the faith to new regions as people fled hostility. It helped to settle the challenge that church leaders faced on what belonged in the canon of the New Testament scripture. The tests they applied to setting the canon had to be rigorous because they knew that people would not give their lives for just spurious inklings. Persecution also sharpened the thinking of church leaders as they defended the faith in the face of often erudite attacks by pagan critics. What's interesting is that the vast majority of arguments against the faith voiced by critics and skeptics today were leveled by critics of the first through third centuries. These critics were learned men, skilled in philosophy and rhetoric. But each of their objections were amply answered by early Christian fathers known today as the apologists. The answers that modern-day apologists use in defense of the faith are largely built on the pioneering work of the originals. Even many of the objections raised by the new atheists are rebutted by 2,000-year-old answers. Though it's questionable whether or not they ever read them, the early apologists wrote some of their defenses of Christianity to the emperor, seeking to reason with him on why persecuting Christians was bad policy. These apologies, as they're called, weren't wild-eyed polemics threatening the emperor with God's wrath if they didn't lighten up. No, they were attempts to use Roman law, Greek philosophy, and the weight of tradition, which, remember, Romans put great store by, to persuade the emperor that Christianity ought to be tolerated along with Rome's other faiths. All that is persecution's upside. But, well, what about the down? Well, believers ended up so busy protecting themselves that there was scant opportunity for them to develop a deep theological heritage to enrich those who came after them. Yes, there were a handful, like the apologists, who managed to get out some material. But with the many thousands who did, in fact, come to faith, we would expect a much larger body of literary work. Persecution limited the opportunity to produce that, and what work that was produced was frequently used as fuel that the fires were then burned on. Another problem that arose that we'll get to later was what to do with believers who faltered during persecution and gave in to the pressure to recant. What was to be done with those Christians who, well, would burn a pinch of incense and say Caesar is Lord? They would take the labellae, and then once the threat of persecution was passed, repent of recanting, and they wanted to come back to church. These were called the lapsed, because their faith had lapsed in the heat of persecution. Another negative effect of persecution was a warped result of a positive. The faith and courage of the martyrs not only challenged the shallowness of rank paganism, and inspired people to, well, follow their example. Not just to live by faith in Jesus, they went further and longed to die like their martyr heroes. The desire to suffer martyrdom became a problem that church leaders had to address. Think of that. Instead of Pastor Alexius asking for volunteers for the nursery ministry, he has to plead with his people not to go to the marketplace crying out that they're Christians. Please, somebody arrest and torture me to death. But it yields a hint as to just how highly the martyrs were regarded in the early church. When they were regarded that highly, it's not difficult to see why there were some who regarded lapsed believers as scum. What made for a major brouhaha was when it wasn't just everyday church members who lapsed, but when it was a pastor, a dilemma that the church had to deal with. We're going to leave that for a later lesson. But let's end with what the early history of the church that we've looked at in this episode has to teach us. What lesson that we might draw from it? Well, in those first couple of centuries, Christianity was regarded as a novelty, you'll remember, in a culture committed to the sanctity of tradition. Now, here we are 2,000 years later, and things have reversed. Now the church is regarded as an irrelevant relic by a culture that's fascinated with the new and improved, in the United States and Canada, at least. Europe's longer history nurtures a lingering regard for tradition, but the massive cultural influence of the United States competes with it for the European soul. Whatever form the world takes, whether it's ancient Rome or the modern West, it's always a reflection of humanity's fallenness. Oh, sure, it occasionally produces beautiful art, music, devises ways to improve health, extend life. It may even develop systems that promote justice. But history is the long, sad tale of how humans manage to tear down what's built up. There's something perverse in the human spirit that delights in destruction. An image comes to mind. A bright, creative child of 9 builds an elaborate castle of wooden blocks. He spends an hour on it. He's proud of his creation. And then in walks his little brother, who takes one look at it and sees nothing but something to destroy. And so he picks up a block and he throws it with all of his might, and it comes crashing down. How many times has that scene been replayed by both children and adults over the centuries? The world will use either tradition or a fascination with change to attack the work of God. Either is a ready tool to oppose the emergence of God's kingdom. Whatever works. Satan is, after all, a pragmatist. Whether the followers of Jesus are dealing with the world's commitment to tradition or change, the point is, the gospel is always countercultural. The contest that we face today is to remain steadfast in our commitment to the historic, orthodox Christian faith, or, as Jude says in the third verse of his brief letter, the faith which was once for all delivered to the saints. Unless you've been living in a monastery or eschew all forms of media, you're probably aware of how swiftly and dramatically the moral landscape has changed just over the last decade. The secular steamroller that began in the 1960s gained speed slowly, accelerated through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and then kicked into high gear after the turn of the century. And now it seems to be moving swiftly downhill. The pressure is on Christians to conform, to drop our commitment to what's deemed by the world as an old-fashioned, out-of-date, and ultimately repressive morality. The gospel makes us countercultural. To be a Christian will always mean being called to a lifestyle that is countercultural, because no matter how aligned the culture Christians live in aligns with the biblical worldview, it's still a fallen world. It's not the kingdom of God. We can't alter our view of what it means to be human and the rules that govern life because we don't make them. God does. While the world presses on us to get with the program and shed our narrow-minded bigotry regarding gender and race, sex, we can't. We must do what those first Christians did, live by and in a morality commensurate with people in love with God. That means loving and serving our fellow man. We must show the superiority of the life that we have to the busted imitation the world offers. That is what won converts to the faith in the first, second, and third centuries. The irresistible influence of Christians hated by the world and hounded by the state, and it's what will win converts today. As all the organs of cultural influence press a message on the church of comply or fry, may our unbelieving family members, friends, neighbors, fellow students, and workmates see and hear in us the truth that the gospel of Jesus Christ is the power to save those who believe.